You're listening to the Musical Ecology's Radio Hour. I'm your host, Dan Joseph, and once a month we bring you a mix of conversations and musical selections by artists featured on the Musical Ecology series in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I invite you to visit our website for more information on our artists and upcoming events at musicalecologies.net. For tonight's program, we'll revisit our event on Thursday, January 12th, with baritone Thomas Buckner. A major figure in the New York musical avant-garde, Buckner has been a steadfast advocate of new and improvised music for over four decades as a performer, presenter, producer, and benefactor. On this night, he performed a one-hour program of works for voice and electronics by Robert Ashley, Alvin Lucier, and Anaya Lockwood. But we began the evening with a wide-ranging conversation about his life and his career. Let's listen now to my conversation with baritone Thomas Buckner at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
So, where should we begin? I guess
you're asking the question.
Yes, I am asking the question, more or less.
I mean, I could, no matter what question you ask, I could say what I came to say.
Right. Well, of course, we're fairly well acquainted. I should say. So I know a lot about you, of course, already. So, but one question that I guess I never really, I don't know that I actually know the answer to is how is it, Tom, that you, what was the sort of the catalyst for you turning towards experimental and music in the way that you have and improvisation? What was the catalyst for that? Because you've really embraced it, big time. Yeah.
Well, they're each different. Improvisation came first, and it came very early. It's a strange story. I was sent to a boarding school when I was 13, and they had very arcane and strict rules. You couldn't have a radio. You could bring your own record collection, but you couldn't have any idea what was going on. And when I got to the third year, I was singing all the time. I started singing when I was very young, and doing a lot of classical work at the place, singing in the choirs, and really had no idea there was such a thing as experimental music or music or even improvisation.
Right.
Really.
And we're talking boarding school. We're talking pre-college.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was like when I was about, I think it was 16. A fellow came, some people came to the school like for the last 2 years. And there was a guy who had, he was a trumpet player and he had a record collection. And he played me a recording of Miles Davis. I'd been so isolated, I didn't know what was happening. You know? I was so impressed with the way he bent the tones of the trumpet and the way it sounded almost like a voice. And so as I left, his room, my friend's room, I had to go to the bathroom. This was a very old building with, in the stalls of the bathroom, there were stone walls between the places. So there were thick pieces of stone where we now have those little metal things. And so I was humming the tune that I'd heard and bending the tones a little bit, and I happened to hit upon the resonant frequency of the space.
Oh, the space, nice.
And then I started experimenting with the sound. And from then on, I was experimenting with, I guess, this form of vocal improvisation. And then I started learning as many standards as I could learn. I tried to learn jazz singing as well. So I had that going as a personal exploration with no idea what context it might ever fit into, but I was just doing it.
Right.
Then when I was involved in singing. At first, I got my first area of concentration was early music. I was singing mainly Elizabethan songs with a very fine lute player, and we were doing some touring and performing. And
this would have been still in those years or in college?
Actually, I skipped something. Excuse me, I made a mistake. College came next, and that's when the improvisation thing did begin to happen. I ended up leaving college on the East Coast and going west. And I was first at the University of Santa Clara, where they had a really fine theater scene going, very good directors, and they ended up founding a Shakespeare Festival. Mm-hmm. And I ended up composing music for the Shakespeare Festival and running a Madrigal group. And sometimes I found that when I would write out something, I'm a slow composer, and it would take me a long time. The director didn't like it, and I'd have to go do it again. So I started experimenting with bringing a small group of instrumentalists and giving them instructions and trying different styles, and then finishing it once he decided what he wanted, saving myself having to rewrite things over and over again.
Right.
So I was using improvisation in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to Stanford, I ran into a man who sort of changed my life, and that was my dear friend David Wessel, who passed away a couple of years ago, who was at Stanford getting his PhD in mathematical psychology.
Mathematical psychology.
Yes, which is the measurement of perception using early on use of computers. They had a one-element model that allowed them to, for example, David's thing was on the acuity of the eye. How much difference, where does the eye cease to perceive mm-hmm. the difference if you speed up thing or if you slow it down?
But in a statistical kind of...
Yeah, yeah, it was all statistics and science, yeah. Mm-hmm. And but he was also a jazz drummer all through high school and was very interested in improvisation. And we started an improvisation group because we had friends in Chicago who were starting. You're doing completely free improvisation. This mm-hmm. was in 1966.
Right.
He had a friend who was a flute player, and the three of us would get together, and we had to make like reel-to-reel tapes and send them to our friends in Chicago, and they would send reel-to-reel tapes of their work back to us.
Wow.
Now, these days, you laugh at that. You can just send whatever you have in mind, right, whenever you want. And we were all trying. The members in Chicago were dealing with theater games, because mm-hmm. a fellow who ran that group, Bill Matthew then, William Matthew, who did some arranging for Stan Kenton,
right.
heard of him, was one of the music directors for the Second City.
Uh-huh.
And he would be improvising piano accompaniments to their theater improvisations. And Viola Sporin, who was one of the founders of that, came up with these theater games.
Mm-hmm.
So Bill started adapting them to musical improvisation games. And simple things like Gather Ye, where you would learn to fold in together,
mm-hmm.
or follow the leader, or somebody would be the leader in there. But the idea basically to get people to give up their holding back and to give in, and it's sort of like the yes and thing that's now around in the theater. That all came from way back then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And lots of different games, and he could therefore work not only with people who had a jazz background and were improvisers in one style,
right.
but with classical people who would
right.
be able to just take the idea of the theater game and be unself-conscious about the musical content and
right.
begin
just
to
sort
develop.
Of lose your inhibitions.
Yeah, and then find ways of making it make sense. The
right.
games would really help. And then eventually the game rules could fall away and you could just improvise. So we were doing that, and that was very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And partway through that year, I was getting my master's in linguistics, having gotten one at Santa Clara in English literature.
So you were still at Stanford at this time?
Yeah, I was at Stanford when I met David. Yeah, and we
I
started
see.
That group.
Uh-huh.
I remember we put on a big performance with a large group of people, and we had a lot of people came, and mm-hmm. all was full. I think it's Bill Auditorium there at Stanford. And at a certain point in our performance, there were theater people involved and music people. And the music faculty got up en masse and said, goodbye, and walked out. So I thought, we must not be doing everything wrong.
Right.
That
wrong.
Was an exciting period. There's a lot of activity with people of various different backgrounds
right.
involved in improvisation.
Right.
And then I was doing this early music, and I was having trouble with the places that were presenting it.
Hmm. Right. Where were they? Churches?
They were different small series that didn't seem to me to be really treating musicians right, and I had the opportunity to try to do it myself, see if I could do better. And I started 70 50 hour concerts.
I see. When did that start?
72.
So this was in this by that time you were living in Berkeley or had
yeah,
you, or?
I moved to Berkeley. Oh, how I got to Berkeley is because that also relates up. What happened is halfway through the year at Stanford, I realized that I didn't want to get a master's in
Linguistics.
Linguistics, because I realized that I wasn't qualified. Everybody else in the class could speak seven languages. And I realized that I didn't have the wherewithal to do it. And I was more interested in music. I was, whatever I was studying, I was doing music always, and, you know.
Right.
You'd say on the side, but actually I was spending more time on music than what I was supposed to be doing. And so I decided to leave, and they notified the draft board that I was now no longer in school, and the Vietnam War was going on, and I got my 1A classification in the mail, and I decided to, I listened to a recording of the great Alia Bhar Khan performing classical North Indian music on the sarod. This is the sarod, you know, it's done with the sarod and a drone instrument and a tabla, and morning and evening ragas. The first morning one was supposed to be heroic, and the evening one was romantic, and all this was to be done with just these, you know, one percussion and one non-harmonic instrument. I thought, this is impossible. And I put it on, and of course I was totally blown away. And I found out through David that Alia Bhar Khan was being brought to Berkeley that summer to teach at the American Society for Eastern Arts. Thing they were renting rooms from the universities.
Was this your first encounter with
Indian
music?
Absolutely, or? Never heard a note of it in my life.
I see.
But I was so blown away by it. I thought, well, the first thing I should do. Now, I didn't go to music school. Now I want to be a musician. Oh, what made me decide? Mm. At Stanford, I went to a concert where the Borodin String Quartet performed Webern's five movements for string quartet, and I came out of that concert and said, if music can do that, then I'm telling this other stuff. I'm going to do music, regardless whether it's writing about it or writing it or singing it. But singing is what I love to do most.
Right.
But I thought, well, I started studying. As soon as I quit, my friend Bill Matthew had moved out there by then. And he's a very well-trained composer, so I studied harmony, counterpoint, and composing with him.
Right.
And I studied with Alia Bhar Khan, an intensive course in the summer. And he was very generous because he wanted everybody to come to his class with what they could do.
Right.
And so he said, once he saw me struggling to try to take this road class, he said, you're a singer, just come to the class and sing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, well, since you sing well, why don't you come to all three classes? So I went to the beginning, middle, and advanced class and learned lots of ragas.
Nice.
It was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
The idea for my ambition for doing it was not to try to become an Indian musician, but to get freed of major and minor and get into thinking, be able to think freely in more modes and sing, change, mix them up and stuff.
And so that brought about your relocating to Berkeley?
Yeah, when I got there to Berkeley, then I met the woman who was to become my first wife, and we settled in Berkeley.
Right.
While I was at that school, I met the lute player that I did the Elizabethan song with.
Is that Joe Bacon?
Joe Bacon, yeah.
Right. Okay.
He was a protege of Julian Reed, and they were best friends. So he was playing some Elizabethan music on the lute on the stairway in the lobby of the place. When I came out of class, I said, I have all these lute songs that I've been doing with harpsichord because I don't have any lute player. And so he came down to my place and we started reading through them. And a couple years later, we were doing a concert at Wigmore Hall in London.
Nice.
And did some touring around the country. But I was very, you know, you had to work regularly at home. And I didn't want to travel much because I had one child and we adopted five more, and I didn't want to be away from my kids when they were little.
Right.
So I tried working in little local places, and you know, things would happen, like the place would fold and not tell you, so you'd go to perform and have all your friends coming, and the place would be closed. and then in general, they just were not, you know, well publicized or organized.
Right.
So I thought, I can do better than this, and so I started 1750 Arts Concerts.
Right.
But by that time, I wanted to do new music, early music, sort of chamber jazz. We were in a house, so we couldn't do jazz with a drum set. We had to do, had to do things that were quieter.
Right.
We had our, you know, there was a lot of music from around the world. This is before the term world music existed, but we had, in every month, we put a calendar out that had world, early, new, classical, jazz.
Right. And so just to pause for it. So we're talking now about 1750 Arch Street, right?
In Berkeley,
Berkeley.
That was the first thing.
Both the address, but also the name of the
organization. It was a concert series, it was a concert series, and we were able, we were able to get hold of this building for a very, very cheap price because it had been built by a very eccentric man in the 30s, and he died in the 50s, and between then and 1972, nobody lived in it.
It had just been sitting there.
Yeah, and the family had occasionally camped out in it, but it was a white elephant.
Wow.
And so it was silly. It was the only good investment I ever made. It was very undervalued.
Nice.
So we were able to have friends who were really good engineers and worked with the local studios, which were thriving because that was the San Francisco rock scene was happening then in the 70s.
Sure, a lot of recording studios.
And so they were able to get me a really good professional quality studio for the price of an average amateur quality studio.
So you also had a recording studio.
Yeah, we had a studio in the basement, and we could record the concert room. And the eccentric guy who built the place was an amateur musician. He was a violinist, and the whole ground floor of his house was one big music room. The whole idea was his friend Yasha Heifetz would come up from L.A. and play chamber music with him.
So this began around 72.
Yeah,
that's when you started the concerts.
I started the concerts, and that went for 8 years. And during that time, I was crazy. We presented 100 concerts a year between September and June. We took July and August off.
Wow, 100 concerts.
Up to
a
little over 100. We do at least two a week. Sometimes 3 or 4 a week.
Right. And you had some kind of staff or some.
I had one person. After a while, I did it for a couple of years, and then I hired two.
You did it all by yourself
for about a year. And
100 concerts a year.
Well, I just got on the phone and called people up and asked them.
Wow.
Well, it didn't get up to 100 right away.
I see. But eventually.
We started doing, Friday and Saturday, and then we would have monthly Sunday afternoon concerts free for senior citizens. And then I was sending people to perform in the prisons.
Right.
So we had a lot of things happening.
Right. And again, it was early music, new music, world
classical music,
world
music and jazz,
chamber jazz. So
yeah.
So all the bases. So did you have some kind of rotation, or was it just sort of?
Well, no,
free,
just
free?
I'd had some was. Well, then what happened is that the radio station, the Pacific station out there,
KPFA,
approached me. Charles M. Conning approached me about having the opportunity to broadcast our Friday night concerts live to the whole Bay Area and all the way down to Fresno. So of course I said, I'll think about it.
No streaming?
No streaming. So I had to schedule the Friday nights so that each Friday would be interesting compared to the Friday before and after it. And that in a month you'd cover, a month and a week, you'd cover all five categories. But I also specialized more in new music for that one.
For the radio part.
So there was a little bit like juggling.
So for a while then there was a regular Friday concert
broadcast on KPFA. For about 7 years.
For 7 years, wow. Amazing.
Yeah, it was really nice.
And I gather, I've never really investigated it in depth, but if I'm remembering right, much of this archive, I mean, there's quite a bit of it is archived from, I mean, just the general Pacifica KPFA music department.
So everything we did on Friday is recorded by them and presented somewhere out there on the internet. And then the others, I mean, I have not been good about trying to get things archived.
There's so much stuff.
Yeah.
I mean,
besides, I'm too interested in what I'm doing now.
Right. Well, I was just curious. I mean, just to think back on that.
So that was a lot of stuff.
Eventually we started a record label.
Yeah,
right?
Well, the record label came out because I had been invited to be in an early music group called Musica Mundana, which had three singers, three instrumentalists, three gamba players, one of whom also was the leader of the group, played organetto and lute. He was a real, really music scholar, very amazing man.
Wow.
David Fallows. He's rather famous in early music circles for performing editions he's made. He had just made performing editions of secular songs of Dufay that were never been performed. So he formed a group. He was taking over the Collegium Musica of Berkeley for that year as a graduate student there getting his PhD, and he went back to get his PhD after he was already out in the world doing realizations for major groups in Europe. And we started performing these things then we thought we'd like to record them, and by that time I'd been trying to record the Elizabethan music, and the commercial studios just were not appropriate for what we were trying to do. They would set up for jingles and rock bands. So that's why I decided to put the studio in 750 yards.
Right.
The first two projects did our gamut. We did the Music of Madonna, the early music, and the next thing was an anthology of American text sound poetry that Charles Evercunningham put together. And that was a really nice record. And then I sort of, it was that label, unlike what I've done with Musical Music, was very eclectic. It did all styles, just like the series did.
Sure.
But it got more and more focused.
Well, it sounds like it was very much like your programming at Arch.
Yeah, it was. It was related, reflected the programming.
So there's certainly a lot of the same elements mixed in the catalog. But
then presenting the new music aspect, I got really fascinated by the music I was hearing.
Right.
And then when Luigi Dallapiccola passed away, he had done some teaching at Cal Berkeley, and my friend Robert Hughes, the composer whose work I presented in the series, had the idea of putting together a memorial concert for Dallapiccola, and we put together a new music chamber group of about 22 people in order to have enough people for the very odd orchestrations that Dallapiccola used. Mm-hmm. He would do very strange ensembles with no regard for whether it was practical to have them perform a lot. He just wanted to have what he was hearing.
Right.
And at the end of that project, one of the viola players in the group, he said, "You guys should continue this." And so we did, and we started the Arch Ensemble, which was a 23-piece ensemble on the model of the Domaine Musicale. With all one of each instrument, plus piano and two percussion and electronics. And our electronics guy was Don Buchlin. So he was doing very well. And we were the only group on the West Coast that was that large that would play the music of local composers. So that's what we did.
And were you able
about
to
10 years.
Were you able to do those programs at Arch Street, or did you go to bigger venues?
And we had to go to bigger venues. We were very fortunate. Bob spoke with the woman who ran the music at Mills College then, Margaret Lyon. She was an early music person, but she thought that Mills should, in its tradition of having had me or there and stuff, support new music. So we got a free home for our East Bay concert, and then we did different venues in San Francisco. So every concert was done in San Francisco and in Oakland. And then a third one was we found a place to do a runout. So each program, each composer got his piece performed, or her piece performed three times.
Wow.
And we did three of those a year. That was very exciting.
That was the Arch Ensemble.
Yeah, that really got that
Robert Hughes.
That and hearing so much experimental music in the in my own series that I was presenting, and going to some of the things at Mills got me switching. And the other thing is, the most exciting thing about doing new music to me is not just that the music is really interesting, but you get to work with the composers.
Right.
People ask me, and they say, "Well, you know, how come you specialize in new music?" Well, I'm engaged in early music performance practice. I perform the music of my own time, just as they did then. Because until Beethoven, nobody ever was interested. After he died, people were going back to Beethoven, but nobody went back to Bach until Mendelssohn decided to.
Right.
Nobody was interested in hearing music from earlier times.
Right.
The scholars had to go find stuff that was not being used.
Right. Well, that leads me to think of, you know, that sort of leads me to more into the present.
Yeah, which is
so
not
this
bad,
is.
Yeah.
I mean, we could tell. I could listen to you telling stories about your California years for night, and there's
an awful
lot of great
stuff enough.
Here. And at some point, you moved to New York. But the bridge for me, in my mind anyway, is the interpretation series, which you've been doing here all these years in New York, but which you've made a core principle of presenting only living composers.
Pretty much. There's been occasional things where pieces have gotten in. But basically, for 1 year, I had a nice irreverent subtitle, "Nothing by Anybody Dead."
but there have been some exceptions.
Yes, there
but basically, that's
well, those
one
are
the
immortals.
Guiding principles.
Those were immortals.
Right.
The music's interesting enough.
Right. So when did you come to New York? What year?
Well, I came in 83. I got the idea to move back in 79 when I was invited to New Music New York. As a kind of an observer, and
that was part of the New Music America.
It was before New Music America existed. It's
I
the
see.
Precursor. The next
precursor.
Year they started
right.
New Music America.
I see.
And
New York.
I think you said you were there too, weren't you, Tom?
1983.
It was a life-changing.
1979.
Oh, 1979.
It was a life-changing experience. I'd heard so much creativity and so many people doing things. I thought, if I'm really serious, by that time I really wanted to switch and just do contemporary music in the Bay Area. I was, singing in local opera productions and singing Messiahs and Bach oratorios. I worked with the Bach Society out there, the California Bach Society. It was really fun, but I wanted to be able to spend full time on new music.
Right.
There was no way to do it. So I thought, well, I could go to New York and work with these people. That would be good.
Absolutely.
Took me a few years to get it together.
Right. So 1983 is when you...
Yeah, it came out. And that was right on the cusp. It might be interesting to talk a little bit about the stuff we're going to hear tonight.
Absolutely. Well, sure, we can jump right into it.
That would kind of lead into it because hey, Kofi. Thanks for coming out. The last year of the Arch Ensemble, we had decided not to continue after 10 years. The conductor didn't want to conduct anymore, and I was thinking of moving east.
Right.
We finally got a consortium grant from the NEA to commission a composer, and we decided to commission Robert Ashley, because he was doing his things at Mills at the same time as we were doing ours. I wasn't able to get out to much of what Bob was doing at Mills because I was also raising 6 children.
And concerts every night.
I didn't show up at all the concerts. I got volunteers. I got to some of them.
Right, but you were very busy over there.
I programmed them all.
Right.
And I helped direct the Arch Ensemble, and I ran the record label. I said I was crazy. Or young, both. I said that would be great, and I remember Bob made the most wonderful statement. He said that Bob Hughes, the conductor, he said, I think we should invite Bob Ashley because I think he has the most original mind in contemporary music.
Hmm.
It's a very specific statement, and I think at the time, and it may still be true. So I said, that's great, but I would like to make sure that he does a piece that will include voice, because I really like what he's doing. I'd like to try to sing that music. And luckily, Bob had heard me enough that instead of giving us an occasional piece, he gave us a piece for chamber orchestra and voice that was a setting of a part of the opera he was working on then called Atalanta, Acts of God.
Uh-huh.
And it was the Odalisque arias in praise of the Odalisque. He made a really nice version with chamber orchestra, but he had to write out the, when you work, his normal way of working is that the rhythms come from the speech rhythms, and the melodies, the spontaneously invented melodies by the singers, come from the declamation of the text, the way it goes up and down when you naturally speak.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, he wasn't going to be working with the singer, and he hadn't taught anybody else how to do it successfully. He didn't get the students there to do it when he wanted. So he wrote out the speech rhythms in absolutely strict musical notation.
Mm-hmm.
You find this case in connection with a single woman of high family and low taste. That shows something. Her grandmother disapproved. They always do. But that didn't stop her. The father's side of the family was said to be to blame. They were in architecture, which is evidently respectable, but... I'm sorry. Yeah, evidently respectable, but artistic, nevertheless. I spoiled the joke. I started to cough. Anyway, then what happened was I moved into New York and I had a loft and I had a roommate staying with me, a man named Big Black, who is a great, great musician, a tumba player. The tumba is a large conga drum that one plays standing up. And he had a set of 3 of them that he played, and he had worked regularly with Dizzy Gillespie over the years. I mean, he's really a major force.
Right.
And Black was a self-taught musician and taught by his brothers, but entirely by ear. So he didn't read music, which meant he memorized everything on first hearing.
Right.
So he heard me doing this, working on these rhythms, and he started playing along on the drum.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually got so that the voice part and the drum part were completely locked in. And then I went to visit Bob and I did it for him, and he was just rather surprised because nobody had ever done anything that accurately with this stuff before. And so he came out to the West Coast to hear it. And then after we did it, he asked me to be in his company. They were going to go to Rome and do Atalanta in a few months.
That's right.
And I was there, brand new in New York, and I was thinking, well, this sounds really interesting, but would it be possible for me to hear the piece? He said, well, we're doing it at NYU. I mean, listen to me. MIT in Boston, in Cambridge in a couple of weeks. So I went to hear it. And the performance was, for everybody else, a total disaster. The students did not provide him with a good sound system. Instead, they spent the money on a slow scan TV thing. That means they build the image with one line at a time. It's like watching paint dry, only probably worse. And so the lousy sound system and this boring thing happening visually, and half the audience left and asked for their money back.
Wow.
And when it was over, I went backstage, and Bob was ready for me to say, well, I don't think I'll do this. I said, that's great, I'd love to do it, because his performance was so fantastic. Sure. And I could hear the idea, you know, I loved it.
Right.
So then we went, but knowing that I could sing in Italian, he had the aria, the three arias for the Odalisque translated in Italian. And, you know, if you do it in English, you find this case in connection with a single family, with woman, single, I don't know whatever it was. In Italian, it's a much more melodious language. Now, the melody in this next thing that I'm going to show you is also spontaneously invented by the singer. There's only a central pitch. And the instruction to let the language guide your voice into melodies, and a set of chord changes, harmonies. They're bebop harmonies slowed down, so every 30 seconds, the chord changes.
Right.
His idea is that you make up the melody.
Uh-huh.
Spontaneously, based on, if you speak it, abbiamo trovato questo caso, abbiamo trovato questo caso, it's right there. You just put it into a singing voice.
But you have a basic
You have one pitch. Basic pitch that goes with the chord change. And the chord changes.
Embellish as you will.
And the chord changes, and he puts the pitch where he wants it to be in your voice. Now this is what opera composers could learn from Bob. There's some other things they could learn too. But this one particularly is that your voice has a different emotional effect depending on where in your range you're singing. Very simple. You don't say, what's your range? And then you write whatever you want, going all over. You pick an area of the range for the part that you want to have urgency. That's right. In the upper third of the range or quarter of the range. Sure. When you want somebody to be really calm, you put them down where their voice is more comfortable. Because nobody, and thank goodness, sings the same way throughout the range. That's, you know, and it's really true with instruments too.
Sure.
Using the extreme range of an instrument, you're gonna, you know, some instruments are more homogeneous than others. But basically, that idea is just it's so exciting. Anyway.
And that was most of my conversation with baritone Thomas Buckner. After we spoke for a bit more, the evening continued with three works for solo voice and electronics. Let's listen first to Robert Ashley's The Mystery of the River, performed by baritone Thomas Buckner at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
River runs east to west with high ridges on either side. This is mountain country. River runs east to west with high ridges on either side. Slopes seem imagination to have been sculpted at some time in the past to an almost perfect smoothness hidden now by the ragged overgrowth. River runs east to west with high ridges on either side. Slopes were sculpted at some time in the past to an almost perfect smoothness. Slopes are covered with trees now. The work is hidden. At a certain point in the river, according to history, something strange happened. The river runs east to west, high ridges on either side. Slopes were sculpted some time in the past to an almost perfect smoothness. Slopes are covered with trees now. The work is hidden. At a certain point in the river, there's evidence of a more mysterious kind of work, complex kind of structure, also hidden. This structure is referred to in stories about the river. When the people in the woods speak about the river, their attention is always and inevitably focused on the mystery of the place in the river where something strange happened. Slopes were sculpted sometime in the past, an almost perfect smoothness. When the people of the area speak about the river, their attention is always inevitably focused on the mystery of the place in the river. There's something strange happening. Chicken said they're going to wear that smoothest thing out. I said, Chicken, that's the only thing they've got. Chicken said, well, why don't you tell them how we got the mule down out of the tree? When the people of the area speak about the river, their attention is always inevitably focused on the mystery of the place in the river, for something strange, where there is evidence of a mysterious kind of work, complex structure also hidden. Structure is described in the story of the river. Its orientation is described in absolutes, though in fact, with respect to perfect north and perfect south, east, and west, as these terms are used to help us to imagine the sphere of Earth, its orientation is skewed to conform to perfect north, as determined by Earth's position in the heavens. The meaning of its position is to be found in our struggles to understand the periodicity of events. When the people of the area speak about the river, their attention is always inevitably focused on the mystery of the place, where according to history, complex kind of structure, also hidden as work, is part of the plan of the river. When the people of the area speak about the river, they speak about the slopes covered in trees now, sculpted at some time in the past to an almost perfect smoothness, and that the work is hidden. When the people of the area speak about the river, their attention is always inevitably focused on the mystery of the place, where according to history, complex kind of structure, also hidden, is part of the plan of the river. Chicken said they're going to wear that smoothness thing out. I said, Chicken, that's the only thing they've got. Chicken said, well, why don't you tell them how we got the mule down out of the tree? Slopes sculpted at some time in the past to an almost perfect smoothness are covered with trees now. The work is hidden. Also hidden as part of the plan of the river is the more complex structure, its orientation described in absolutes. Though in fact, with respect to perfect north and south and perfect east and west, as those terms are used to help us to imagine the sphere of Earth, its orientation is skewed to confirm the perfect north as determined by Earth's position in the heavens, the meaning of its orientation to be found in our struggles to understand the periodicity of events. It blocks. No, this is a wrong way to begin. To begin with a notion that is rooted in stories and for which we have no precise correspondence, this is the wrong way to begin. And we must begin here because we have no choice. The river, as the people of the area speak about the river, is not infinitely deep, but it is deeper than the water that flows between the sculpted slopes, as the people of the area speak about the river, with its slopes sculpted at some time in the past to an almost perfect smoothness. Now the slopes are covered and the work is hidden. People of the area speak about the river as if smoothly sculpted slopes had been made at some time in the past to hold an invisible curved plane, perfectly erect, not a boundary, at least not in the way the people of the area speak of it. Monument of a sort to the infinite deepness of the river, and at the time when the slopes were sculpted, the work is hidden now, sculpted in the manner of the curved plane of the more complex kind of structure. Slopes covered with trees now have the same degree, the same angle, these are not different, the same smoothness, according to the history of the river, as the sloping walls of the more complex kind of structure. Sloping walls lead the mind to the sloping walls of the more complex structure. More complex structure rests precisely astride the course of the river, positioned in a place in the river where its orientation conforms to perfect north as determined by Earth's position in the heavens. Beyond the more complex structure, the high ridges of the river continue on either side, and from the heights of the ridges to the intersection of the slopes below, the walls of the more complex structure continue in a perfect smoothness, though the shapes are covered with trees now, and the work is hidden. The more complex structure is only partly visible from the ridges. Top part is visible, positioned as it is along the river, where its orientation conforms to perfect north, as determined by Earth's position in the heavens. A huge dam is visible, such as hydroelectric power. Among the parts of the dam visible from the edges are the large entrance doors, where the people of town, part of the more complex structure. We're loaded into the structure. One of the mysteries of the more complex structure is the way the people of the area speak about the river is the mystery of the entrance doors, the large entrance doors. Where the separate items in the lower half of the more complex structure were loaded into the structure. Will the large entrance doors be used again, or is it structure closed for all time? Index of the separate items, once formally recited in precise detail in stories about the river, is long forgotten now. The large entrance doors are closed, perhaps forever, or perhaps only waiting a large plan of time. The more complex structure is only partly visible from the ridges. The top part is visible, a huge dam is visible, source of hydroelectric power positioned in place in the river where its orientation conforms to perfect north as determined by Earth positioned in the heavens. The orientation is described as absolutes, though in fact with respect to perfect north and south and perfect east and west, as those terms are used to help us to imagine the sphere of Earth. Its orientation is skewed to conform to perfect north as determined by Earth's position in the heavens. Thus, the meaning of its position is to be found finally in our struggles to understand the periodicity of events. The river runs east and west, high ridges on either side. When the people of the area speak about the river, they speak about the slope sculpted at some time in the past, to an almost perfect smoothness, and that the work is hidden. Slopes are covered with trees now. When people speak about the river, their attention is focused on the mystery of the place where, according to history, a more complex kind of structure also lives close now, perhaps forever. Waiting a large plan of time is part of the plan of the river, the mystery of the place where something strange happened. When the people of the area speak about the river, their attention is always inevitably focused on the mystery of the place where, according to history, a more complex kind of structure, also hidden, is closed, perhaps forever or perhaps waiting a large plan of time. The river runs east to west, high ridges on either side. Slopes were sculpted sometime in the past to an almost perfect smoothness. Slopes are covered with trees now. The work is hidden. At a certain point in the river, there is evidence of a more mysterious kind of work, a hidden, more complex structure. The structure is always referred to in mythology of the river. When the people of the area speak about the river, their attention is always inevitably focused on the mystery of the place in the river where something strange happened. The river runs east to west, with high ridges on either side, covered with trees now. The slopes are sculpted sometime in the past, to an almost perfect smoothness. Part of a mysterious kind of world, in a certain place in the river, where according to history, something strange happened. The river runs east to west, with high ridges on either side. Slopes were sculpted sometime in the past, to an almost perfect smoothness. Work is hidden now, with huge ridges on either side. Hidden now at the point in the river where something strange happened. Chicken said they're gonna wear that smoothness thing out. I said, chicken, that's the only thing they've got. Chicken said, well, why don't you tell them how we got the mule down out of the tree? Slopes are covered with trees now, the work is hidden. Index of the separate items once formally recited in precise detail in stories about the river is long forgotten now. When the people of the area speak about the river, they speak about the slope covered with trees now, sculpted at some time in the past to an almost perfect smoothness, and that the work is hidden. When the people of the area speak about the river, their attention is always inevitably focused on the mystery of the place in the river where something strange happened. Where there is evidence of a more mysterious kind of work, complex structure, hidden, closed now, closed perhaps forever, or perhaps waiting only in a large plan of time. More complex structure is only partly visible from ridges positioned at the place in the river where its orientation conforms to perfect north as determined by Earth's position in the heavens. When the structure is described in the myth of the river, its orientation is described in absolutes, though in fact, with respect to perfect north and south and perfect east and west, as those terms are used to help us to imagine the sphere of Earth, its orientation is skewed as determined by Earth's position in the heavens. The meaning of its position is to be found in our strategies to understand the periodicity of events.
And that was Robert Ashley's The Mystery of the River, performed by baritone Thomas Buckner. We'll conclude tonight's program with an excerpt from Buckner's performance of Duende, a work he co-composed with composer Anaya Lockwood. Thank you.
Shh.
You've been listening to the Musical Ecologies Radio Hour. For more information, visit our website at musicalecologies.net.